From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. This program is made possible in great part by the generous support of you, our listeners. We couldn't do without you. We're very grateful for your support. For more information on how you can help keep this show on the air, please visit stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. On our interfaith calendar, August 1st is the Christian Feast of Lammas. The Wicca and pagan observance of Lugnasad and Imbolc, and the Jewish Tisha B'Av. At the intersection of religion, government, and politics, an enormous gift to the political religious right came in the form of a presidential tweet announcing reinstatement of a ban on transgender Americans serving in the armed forces. Ridiculous on its face. The act should terrify because it shows how both human lives and our armed forces don't matter when it comes to pandering to the culture warriors who voted so generously for the current president. Once it emerged that the Pentagon was never consulted on this, but the likes of Tony Perkins were, I think it became more clear than ever just how much trouble America really is in. I could say a lot more about this, but for now, let's leave it at the following. Anytime there is an attack from this administration and its enablers on any group of Americans, take the time to insert the word African Americans, or Jews, or women, for whatever group is in the crosshairs, and see if that doesn't help illuminate exactly what is actually happening. A nominee to the federal judiciary has provoked outrage for positions that suggest, quote, judges should be bound by their religious faith, not the law. Amy Coney Barrett's name has been put forward by the Trump administration for a seat on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Seventh Circuit. And failed Kansas governor and prominent social conservative Sam Brownback has been nominated to the position of Ambassador at Large for Religious Freedom. I shuddered when I heard it. The position was last held by Rabbi David Saperstein, the longtime head of the Union for Reform Judaism's Religious Action Center. Now, here's what's coming up this week on State of Belief Radio.
Every one of you are terrorists. I don't care what you say. Every Muslim is a terrorist.
One of the painful realities about the most recent political cycle and its aftermath has been the relentless marginalization of various groups of Americans, whether from some political leaders or their newly emboldened followers. Exclusionary, hateful, and even dangerous rhetoric has flowed like toxic sludge across our land. Among the targets have been American Muslims, and an invaluable analysis of the effects of this has just appeared in the form of a report published by the Pew Forum on Religion and Public Life. It's headlined, U.S. Muslims Concerned About Their Place in Society But Continue to Believe in the American Dream. And we'll get highlights from lead researcher Bashir Mohammed.
Pope Francis said that fundamentalism is a disease of all religions. Fundamentalism is always a tragedy. It is not religious. It lacks God. It is idolatrous, he said.
Political and religious fundamentalism. That's what an article from two leading figures in Pope Francis' Vatican calls the theocratic impulse in American society that we've been railing against for so many years. On this week's show, we'll explore this incendiary statement with journalist Patty Miller. But first...
So, Mr. President, this is you know, clearly a disappointing moment.
A remarkable outpouring of opposition to attempts in the U.S. Senate to assassinate Obamacare continued despite much media attention going elsewhere. Despite Capitol Police at one point ordering journalists to erase photos and recordings of protesters, and despite an utter contempt for the lawmaking process on the part of congressional leaders, on the part of congressional leaders and their supporters. In a moment worthy of the West Wing or House of Cards, late Thursday night, we saw Senator John McCain, back in Washington against doctor's orders, cast the decisive vote against the final of a long series of undefined and unread attempts to kill the Affordable Care Act with the crass promise to craft a replacement bill later, cynically scheduling the actual destruction of a health care bill to happen after the midterm elections. Leaders like the Reverend William Barber were arrested on the Hill again as they spoke out on the moral aspects of Republican efforts to erase President Obama's legacy. And the Catholic Lobby Network brought a letter signed by 7,000 women, religious, to Washington, throwing their considerable moral capital behind defending the Affordable Care Act. For a look at the drama and the lessons of these recent events, I'm delighted to be joined by my great friend, Sister Simone Campbell, the original nun on the bus and executive director of Network. Simone, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Oh, my gosh. It's such a joy to be with you, Weldon, on this day. It's fantastic.
Well, tell me, and I know you want to, what you were feeling as you watched the votes in the Senate on Thursday night?
Oh, it was such a yo-yo of emotions because we knew we needed three Republican votes. And Senator Collins and Senator Murkowski have been strong women leaders. And while Senator McCain may rightfully get a bunch of the credit for casting the final vote that made the difference, considering his illness and all this, Senators Collins and Murkowski, the women leaders of this program, need to be acknowledged as heroines in standing up for the needs of their states. And the one, there's a lot of detail involved in that, but their consistent no votes were so important for the sake of their people. I do this policy, so I was worried that in this, quote, skinny bill, there was no mention of Medicaid at all, and one of Senator Collins and Murkowski's big objections had been the Medicaid provisions of the prior proposals. I was worried that that might be enough to get their vote, but I should have trusted in their good judgment. So when we heard that we had those two and then that we had McCain, it was like, oh, my heavens, this thing may at this moment die. But the other piece that we have to remember is it's not gone. And what the House is currently trying to do with their budget and appropriations procedure is to accomplish some of the same goals with Medicaid restructuring. So we've got to stay alert, stay engaged, stay involved. And while I celebrated the Thursday night victory, I also know that there's hard work ahead. So I don't want anyone to think that it's over. It's not. On Tuesday, before the vote to proceed, I was with Senator Murkowski in a small interfaith visit with her personally and her staff, and she was talking about the anguish that she felt for her state and the threats that she was getting and how she was still in the process of deciding what was the best way forward for Alaska. And she left us at about 11:45 in the morning to go to the Republican lunch where Senator McConnell laid out what the next few days were going to be in his plan. And in the course of that, I think we helped her in saying how we were praying for her and lifting up the stories of Alaskans. But the other piece that touched me so much that she said something about how she clearly was touched by the story of real people, real Alaskans, and I just didn't understand why others weren't touched by their people. So the conversation went on, and she came back to it, and she said to me, "Sister, I want to answer your question. Part of the problem is that many of my colleagues don't meet with ordinary constituents. They seal themselves off from the stories of their people." And I just got tears in my eyes at the sadness of that. And it made me realize that we people of faith who can get access really have a responsibility to bring the stories of real people to members of the Senate and the House who have a narrative that isn't reality.
Simone, you also ought to know that we owe you a debt of gratitude for you staying on top of it and being able to be in those strategic places and talk to someone like that that was right in the middle of it. Where did the idea to gather women religious signatures come from?
Well, that started originally with the original sign-on letter for the Affordable Care Act, you know, because we always did sign-on letters, and so my idea was we get people to do sign-on letters, and that was the idea that sisters run hospitals, we could get sign-on from leadership. But that was back in 2010 when we did that nun's letter. Mm-hmm. This one was, we had a bit more time. I was hearing from sisters all over the country. I knew my sisters were really concerned about what was going on. And so I thought, well, we can reach out just to our people, invite sisters all over the country to sign on. One of the best stories for me was the Sisters of St. Joseph up in Philadelphia. They sent a envelope with 300 of their sisters in assisted living and their retirement community who had signed on to the letter. And so it was like this powerful statement. They knew how much health care meant, and they were standing up for the people. And to see that witness was so, I don't know, it was so moving to me, and it came with this dear note how grateful they were to be able to do it. We have sisters from every state in the union, which was our goal, 7,151, if you want to know the exact number.
In that letter, there is a sentence, quote, "The Better Care Reconciliation Act would be the most harmful legislation for American families in our lifetimes, and it goes against our Catholic faith teaching." What's that mean?
Amen. There were all these different versions of this effort to repeal Obamacare, but the version that's the BCRA would have taken away health care from 22 million people, on top of the people that still don't have health care under the Affordable Care Act. And the fact that I had been around the country and heard the stories of people who were going to lose their care. I met Maria in Tucson, Arizona, who had been a worker all her life, a low-wage worker. She had never had health care until Obamacare. She gets health care with Medicaid expansion in Arizona. She goes to the doctor. Turns out they find early stage ovarian cancer. She's now in treatment. She is terrified that this treatment is going to be interrupted. She works and then cares for her kids and grandkids as the matriarch of the family, and that would be ended. This is not a pro-life stance. Mm. And we as Catholics value the dignity of all life, not just fetuses. It is horrifying to me that we have so politicized the issue of abortion, we've lost sight of the issue of the people. And Maria has as much right to dignity as I do. Dignity and living a healthy life. Our church teaches all should live in dignity. And Pope Francis has said very clearly, health care is a right. It's not a privilege for the rich. It's against our teaching to do this.
Simone, the votes on Thursday were like a shell game with no real clarity about what was in each bill that was in front of the senators. How can we participate in the democratic process as concerned citizens when there's this kind of, I think, deliberate confusion being created?
This process was deliberately obscure, deliberately opaque, deliberately left to make people not know what was going on, and the effort to get to a conference committee or get something passed. It was purely partisan. Tuesday, Republicans told us in meetings they didn't know what was going to happen. They had had this bill that they finally voted on, the so-called skinny repeal, which I call a scammy repeal. They had it in their hands for 2 hours before the vote started. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's wrong. That's not democracy.
Right.
And so what I think we the people have to do, I think we the people talk to all of our representatives about fixing the problems. The challenge is there is a problem, but it's not the problem with the Affordable Care Act. It's a problem with the business model that we're using for medicine. And the problem principally is in rural counties in our nation because healthcare depends on high volume because it's high cost. And so with high cost healthcare, there's not enough volume in rural areas. So how do we change the business model so that services in rural communities can get the service they need? That's the issue. Mm-hmm. And also rural communities tend to be older than the urban environment, so they have a higher utilization, a higher use of healthcare services. Mm-hmm. This is the problem that actually needs to be looked at, and there are people around the country that are working on it. We, the people, have to stand up and say, listen to the people who know what's going on. Mm-hmm. Don't just listen to your donors. Don't just listen to your partisan echo chamber. Stop it and work.
How much impact do you think did the on-the-ground activism of faith leaders like yourself and Reverend William Barber have? Looking from the outside, it seems the only dissenting votes on the GOP side were the ones that had been dissenting all along. How important was the on-the-ground activism?
Oh, my gosh, it's huge. There's a lot of politics in all the other votes and all the other amendments that were up and that people were looking at. And so what people miss, they just see this end vote. But there were other votes where Capito and Portman and Heller voted against a Republican proposal. So that there's a lot of posturing. And our activism really put the pressure on them to care, to engage. And in the end, the pressure from leadership was stronger. But maybe if we actually moved to a conversation, this was really close Thursday night. And so if we hadn't done it, it would have sailed through. We the people is where the power is.
Just for a moment, tell us what you think may be next, your prediction on where this is going.
That's a tough one. They've already started in the 2018 budget effort to include some of the Medicaid restructuring. That is Speaker Paul Ryan's goal. They're trying to slip some of that into the budget. It will be interesting to see after this bruising battle if they're willing to take it up again and have real conversations about how to move forward. I worry that the White House will use its capacity to undermine the exchanges. Well, we just have to be hyper attentive to everything around us, because not only do we have health care to worry about, we have a tax policy to worry about, because it's the next one coming down the pike. And this tax policy is double down on what they call trickle-down economics, where you give tax cuts to the rich with the idea they're going to make jobs. And we've done that failed policy for 35 years, and it hasn't worked, but they want to double down on it.
Simone, is there any hope for lawmakers getting together to work on fixing the Affordable Care Act rather than tearing it down at all costs? Is there a human narrative behind all of the political posturing, or do you think it's too late for that kind of cooperation across the aisle?
I don't know. I haven't talked to anybody since the bruising voting, so it's hard to tell. I know before the vote, weeks ago, Senator Cassidy and some of the Dems were together trying to talk about what would be real fixes, what could make a difference. But then they got told by leadership on the Republican side not to do that anymore because they were going to take care of it. I don't know what kind of heart there will be. And there's not a lot of time. They're way behind on their agenda.
Sure.
So it'll be interesting to see if they're able to touch it. And I think people feel kind of burned by it. So we're going to need to address it. But hopefully there could be hearings. We can move slowly and do something real, not this foolishness. Mm-hmm.
Sister Simone Campbell is the executive director of the Network Catholic Lobby. Simone is the author of the invaluable book, A Nun on the Bus, How All of Us Can Create Hope, Change, and Community. An independent documentary film on the Nuns on the Bus campaigns is almost finished, and you can help get it completed by searching for Nuns at Indiegogo.com. Simone, it's always great talking with you. I am so grateful for you and grateful that you're always willing to come on with us and talk to our friends on State of Belief Radio.
Oh, it's an honor, Weldon. Thank you so much. Together we can make this happen. Hope, change, and community. That's it.
There's lots more still to come on this week's show. We'll hear from Patty Miller on some provocative Vatican comments about the American religious right. And up next, surprising insights on American Muslims from new research courtesy of the Pew Forum. I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. A comprehensive overview of Muslim life in Donald Trump's America has just been released by the Pew Forum on Religion and Public Life, and I am glad to have Bashir Muhammad, lead researcher on this project, join me today on State of Belief Radio. Bashir, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Would you just quickly summarize who you spoke with and the time period during which this study was conducted?
So this was a nationally representative sample of just over 1,000 Muslims. We've been in the field for 3.5 months. We went into the field right after the president's inauguration and continued on for a few months, making these phone calls to get interviews with a wide range of Muslims on all sorts of attitudes and views.
What stood out for you as the most noteworthy among findings?
Well, I think there are a couple of interesting things that we see here. On the one hand, there's a sort of general pattern we see of attention that, on the one hand, they say they're uncertain of, you know, their level of acceptance by society. They talk about experiencing discrimination, and they talk about not feeling like Islam is accepted as part of mainstream society. But on the other hand, they definitely tell us that they're committed to an American identity. More than 9 in 10 say they're proud to be American. The vast majority say that they believe, you know, anyone who works hard can get ahead. So there's this interesting tension that we see among the Muslim American community. It's in line with some of the things that we've seen in the past. You know, we did the survey in 2007 and we did it in 2011. We saw similar patterns of Muslims being well integrated into American society in those previous surveys. But this question about whether you're proud to be American, this is a new question that we explored. And so it was really interesting to see just how high the levels of support were. And the belief that you can get ahead with hard work, that's a question we have asked in the past. And as in the past, Muslims believe in that. Actually, they're a little bit more likely than the public overall to believe that if you work hard, you can get ahead.
Hmm. You know, I think many of us would have expected American Muslims to say life has gotten more difficult in the past year or two. In fact, that doesn't appear to be the case. Talk about that finding, if you would.
It's interesting because while Muslims definitely do say they're proud to be American and that they believe they can work hard, that things are going well in their own lives, the plurality of U.S. Muslims say things have gotten harder in recent years. And the number of Muslims who say that they've experienced some sort of discrimination in the last 12 months has climbed a little bit. It was 40% of Muslims that said this back in 2007, and it's up to 48%, or just about half of Muslims, saying that in the past 12 months they'd experienced some sort of discrimination. So those numbers are sort of ticking up a bit.
Bashir, what answers did you get in connection with the new administration?
Well, what we saw overall is that Muslims have historically been and continue to be a primarily Democratic voting bloc. About two-thirds say they do not approve of the way the president is handling his job. But about 1 in 5 do approve of the way Trump is handling his job as president, at least, you know, as of over the last few months as we did this survey. And so there's not a most Muslims are saying that they're not very supportive, but there is a significant minority, comparable to about the numbers that we saw sort of the tail end of Bush's presidency in 2007, saying that they support President Trump.
I thought some of the most valuable findings were in the way you were able to compare the answers American Muslims gave to key questions to the answers given by all Americans. Talk about that, please, about the comparison and what you see in that comparison.
So we were really excited to be able to do that. On a lot of questions, as you alluded, we were able to ask Muslims and ask the public overall what their views were on issues. You know, one thing, for example, that stood out for me was we asked about extremism in the name of Islam. And we asked Muslims how concerned they are about extremism in the name of Islam in the United States and internationally. And we asked the public overall how concerned they are about extremism in the name of Islam in the U.S. and internationally. And we saw that Muslims really do share the public's concern about extremism. U.S. Muslims are about as likely as the public overall to be very or at least somewhat concerned about extremism in the name of Islam in the U.S., and they're actually slightly more likely than the public overall to be concerned about extremism in the name of Islam around the world. So they definitely share the public's concern about extremism, for example.
Go beyond extremism, and in other comparisons, what does the public see that Muslims see outside the extremist question?
So another question that we asked about was just basic religiosity. You know, how important is religion in your life? And Muslims are about as likely as Christians to say that religion is very important in their lives. About two-thirds of Muslims and about two-thirds of Christians in the U.S. say that religion is very important in their lives. Similarly, levels of attendance at religious services is comparable between Muslims and Christians. So there definitely are a variety of things where we see real similarities.
Bashir, there was one sentence that just really jumped out at me. Let me quote it.
Mm-hmm.
Compared with the U.S. public as a whole, Muslims are more likely to say targeting and killing civilians for political, social, or religious reasons is never justifiable. I'd really like for you to talk a little more about this finding, including the specific percentages for each group, because it is critical in helping undermine uninformed assumptions that a lot of people continue to hold and even promote.
This is one of those other questions that we asked Muslims and we asked the public overall, whether targeting and killing civilians can ever be justified. And what we saw was that Muslims were more likely than the public overall to say that these acts can never be justified. We saw three-quarters of Muslims, 76%, say targeting and killing civilians can never be justified, compared to 6 in 10 members of the general public. So to be clear, among both Muslims and the general public, most people say that these acts can never be justified. And then others say that, you know, they can rarely be justified, sometimes be justified. And we went in some detail. We asked people in some follow-up interviews what they had in mind when they said these things. But the vast majority of Muslims, three-quarters, and 6 in 10 members of the public overall say these things can never be justified.
What did you find in terms of experiences of discrimination or hate incidents? And I'm particularly interested in trends you're able to identify across time.
So there are two interesting things with regard to discrimination. One is that Muslims are saying that they're experiencing more discrimination now than they were 10 years ago. About half of Muslims, 48%, say that in the last 12 months they've experienced some sort of discrimination, whether that's people acting suspicious of them, being singled out by airport security, or being threatened. We asked about a variety of acts. And that's definitely up from, you know, when we first started asking this question in 2007, and we saw 4 in 10 Muslims say this. So we're seeing an upward trend in the levels of discrimination that Muslims say that they're experiencing. Another interesting point related to discrimination, and this is another one of those questions where we ask the public overall, is 7 in 10 members of the U.S. public overall agree that Muslims face a lot of discrimination. So a large portion of the public is sort of cognizant of the fact that Muslims are experiencing a lot of discrimination. 7 in 10 members of the public say this, which is actually higher. It's actually higher than the number of people in the public that say that blacks face a lot of discrimination, that say gays face a lot of discrimination, that say Jews face a lot of discrimination. So we've asked about a lot of different groups. And so do you think that this group faces discrimination? Do you think this group faces discrimination? And the public is more likely to say that Muslims face discrimination than to say that about any other group.
Hmm. If you put side by side this survey with the survey of 07, the survey of 11, what would stand out as major changes between now and back then?
I think a few things stand out as major changes. One of the biggest ones is political. In 2011, Muslims were quite satisfied with the direction of the country and overall approved of the job that the president was doing. And in 2017, that definitely is not the case. Muslims are not happy with the direction of the country. They don't approve of the job that the president is doing. So that's one of those things that definitely does stick out as having changed.
Is there a major finding that I haven't asked about that you need to tell me?
I mean, I think you've covered a lot of the major findings. I think the only other thing that comes out very strongly in the survey, in this data, is the incredible diversity of the Muslim American community. We see a wide range of demographic diversity, racially, ethnically. About 6 in 10 Muslims are immigrants, but 4 in 10 are born in the U.S. There's not a single ethnic group or racial group that forms a majority. There are some that are from the Middle East and North Africa, some from South Asia, countries like Pakistan, India, Bangladesh, but also significant numbers of U.S.-born blacks and other groups. So there's a wide range of racial diversity and also religious diversity. A lot of Muslims say that they believe that there's more than one way to interpret the teachings of Islam. In fact, the majority of Muslims, 2/3, say this. So I think that's the only other theme that really came out strongly for me, was that just the incredible diversity of the Muslim American community.
Great, great point. I'm glad you did. Bashir, what do you see as the potential value of this kind of objective, rigorously reviewed research in an age of argument and opinion?
Well, I think Muslims in the U.S. are a community that is not very large, but is growing quickly, and that there's a lot of public interest in. You know, people want to know about Muslims. People are talking about Muslims. And so the fact that we can bring to the table some data about Muslims, like this is what Muslims are thinking, this is how Muslims are feeling, that aren't just anecdotes, aren't just, well, here's a Muslim, here's a random person, here's someone who was at the mosque that we interviewed, but, you know, a real wide cross-section of the Muslim community, I think it's a real valuable contribution to be able to speak a little bit more confidently about the views, attitudes, and even the diversity of the Muslim American community.
Bashir Muhammad is senior researcher at the Pew Research Center. He served as the lead researcher for the newly released Forum on Religion and Public Life report titled U.S. Muslims Concerned About Their Place in Society But Continue to Believe in the American Dream. You can read it online at pewforum.org. Bashir, you did a great job on this information, and thank you so much for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Well, thank you. It was a pleasure.
More than 15 years after the Catholic bishops helped get George W. Bush elected president, and nearly 8 after the signing of the Manhattan Declaration, the Vatican has discovered what had become the defining feature of the Christian right in America, the conservative evangelical Catholic convergence. That sentence appears in an important Religion Dispatches article headlined, Vatican Fires Shot at U.S. Religious Right, Calls Out Religious Liberty Industry and Evangelical Catholic Alliance. You bet this is something we need to talk about, and I'm joined now by its author, journalist Patty Miller. Patty, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you, Weldon. So glad to be here again.
Who wrote this article, and where was it published?
Well, this was published in a very important newspaper that is not an official Vatican paper, but is reviewed by the Vatican. So I guess you could say it's a semi-official Vatican paper. And the authors were Antonio Spadaro and Marcello Figueroa, mm-hmm. who are both very close to the Pope and are believed to have his ear and are expressing opinions that would not be out of line with what Pope Francis thinks, even though they don't have an official Vatican approval.
Mm-hmm. Patty, I'm interested in context. Was there some event that prompted this, or was it just something that had been in their minds, or do you know what prompted it?
That's a really good question because, as I noted in my article, this is nothing new. This has been going on in U.S. politics now for 15 or 20 years. It's been a developing trend. But honestly, I think what prompted it was Donald Trump and Steve Bannon and the rise of this obviously dominionist theology within the White House. And even Pope Francis had to take notice and say, wait a minute, what's going on here? And when you start to peel back the onion, what the Vatican had to realize was this was not just what we call in this country the Christian right, meaning the evangelical right, but there is a fairly significant radicalized conservative Catholic population in this country. 60% of white Catholics voted for Donald Trump, despite the fact that Pope Francis made his disapproval of him abundantly clear. So I think the Vatican has woken up to the fact that a lot of what's driving politics in this country is coming from a certain segment of a radicalized Catholic Church.
Mm-hmm. Well, you said the authors have a good relationship, close relationship with the Pope. How likely is it that the ideas put forth in the article are shared by Pope Francis?
I think it's very likely. They are not the kind of people, nor is this the kind of publication that would put out something like this if they didn't have the Pope's at least general agreement. I imagine they're probably more expert than the Pope is on the specifics of U.S. politics. I mean, they name Steve Bannon by name. They name the Church Militant, which is this right-wing group which is taking up the kind of crusade against the Muslims by name. So clearly I think they're the ones who are paying attention to what's happening here on the ground, perhaps more closely than what Pope Francis is doing in his job, but clearly he does not disagree with what they're saying. And after all, this received a good bit of attention, more attention in Europe, I think, than in the U.S., Pope Francis never came out and disowned it or said, I don't disagree with this, or made any comment to that effect. So I think that's important.
Well, let's do some details. So what were the key criticisms of the political religious right in this country?
Well, the two key criticisms, one is that they are ignoring the global ecological crisis. And the other is their what they call like an Armageddon-infused rhetoric against Islamic fundamentalism, their Armageddon-infused rhetoric against Islam, which they actually draw parallels to Islamic fundamentalism and how far over they've gone on in their assertions about the Islamic religion. So those are the two main kind of points. But the bigger overall point was that they are seeking influence in the political sphere so that public norms can be subject to religious morals, so that they are basically seeking a theocracy where public spheres are infected by their idea of religious morals and norms.
They should have had the picture of the prayer meeting in the White House to put with this article.
Well, and this came out right around the same time, so and obviously this has probably been in the works for some time, but that was the perfect illustration of what they're talking about, although that was just evangelicals. There was no Catholic bishops
right.
there. I think the Catholic bishops have stepped away from that kind of direct involvement, unlike during the Bush administration, which they were very present in the White House during the George W. Mm-hmm. Bush administration. But clearly that is the perfect example of people claiming that they are sanctified by God, so therefore their policies are the correct policies. And they've actually managed to twist their logic around where Donald Trump is some unlikely messenger from God who's helping them get their policies into action, even though he himself is obviously a deeply imperfect Christian. So that is some pretty twisted fundamentalist logic for you there.
It certainly is. Did anything in the article surprise you?
Well, I can't say it surprised me because I've followed these trends for a long time. What a little bit didn't surprise me, but is I think a little ironic, is they themselves probably did not acknowledge the degree to which the Vatican, not necessarily Pope Francis, but his two predecessors, really pushed conservative Catholics towards this partnership with the evangelicals by really focusing on abortion and same-sex marriage as the two key issues that Catholics really should care about. They basically drove a good segment of the Catholic population right into the arms of the Republican Party. And there's no acknowledgement so much in this article that this happened, you know, this happened because things were done in the Catholic Church that caused a chain event of political outcomes mm-hmm. in this country. It might be beyond the scope of their article, in all honesty, but I think they do a little bit need to acknowledge this did not happen in a vacuum. This happened because of a set of Vatican policies. And Pope Francis, although he's tried to balance concern about abortion and same-sex marriage with other concerns about the environment, with immigrants, he has still retained a very conservative outlook on reproductive rights and women in general and certainly LGBT issues. So, you know, a little bit, you can't take Francis out of this equation completely, I think.
Yeah. Do you think this is likely to have any impact at all on the evangelical Catholic political alliance in the United States?
Personally, I don't think so, because I think evangelical Catholics, what I'm calling evangelical Catholics, are now so firmly aligned in their identity with being anti-abortion and with being Republicans and with being small government conservatives that they have literally just ignored Pope Francis. They don't particularly like Pope Francis. They don't agree with him. So after insisting for years during the papacies of Pope John Paul II and Pope Benedict that it was not okay for Catholics to ignore the Pope, they've suddenly decided it's just fine for Catholics to ignore the Pope. So I don't think they particularly care. They've made their choice, basically. It's kind of way too late down the line at this point to pull these Catholics alliances back from the far right where they have been cemented.
So, Patty, what does this tell us about the future that the hierarchy envisions for the American Catholic Church?
Well, you know, I think we're going to see a church that looks very much like our political sphere. Francis is bringing in bishops and cardinals who are more, I don't want to use the word progressive, I don't think that's the right word, because they're still quite socially conservative, but they're more balanced in their outlook. And they're certainly much more concerned about poor people and immigrants and the environment than the pre-Francis bishops. They are still a minority, and you saw that at the bishops' annual meeting recently. They tried to get some concern going for immigration policy, and they were kind of shut out by the bishops who still want to worry about religious liberty, and I'm putting that in scare quotes because that's their form of religious liberty. So we may end up seeing a church that's as polarized as our politics, where there's a new ascendant, more progressive wing under Pope Francis, and an older, more, you know, solidified conservative wing that's going to hold on for dear life and just hope Francis eventually goes away and they can kind of re-up their supremacy in the both in the U.S. Bishops' Conference and in the Vatican.
How do you ignore the Pope and remain Catholic?
The same way, I guess, anyone, you know, there's been a lot of studies on how people just ignore values and ideas that don't comport with their own. And the Pope is not speaking things, when he speaks especially about the environment, that is not something that conservative evangelical Catholics care about. They are kind of dominionists now. They believe we should just use the environment the way we want to and burn fossil fuels and have as many kids as you want. And So it's very easy psychologically to make up a reason why you don't have to listen to somebody, even if it is literally the Pope.
Hmm. Have you seen or do you expect to see anything in print responding to this article?
There already have been a number of responses. Not surprisingly, Charles Chaput, Archbishop of Philadelphia, he called the article an exercise in dumbing down and inadequately presenting the nature of the Catholic evangelical cooperation on religious freedom and other key issues.
so he didn't like it.
Yeah, as far as he's concerned, this was an emergency cooperation between these groups to push back on the tide of secularism and abortion and gay rights, and they had no choice but to come together, put aside their traditional theological differences, and pretty much make this emergency alliance to save the culture. So as long as you're positing what you're doing is saving the culture, you know, from the infidels inside the church, You're always going to think you're right. The people who are kind of in your circle, they think they have they have God on their side as far as they're concerned, and it's the Pope who's wrong.
Patty, you know this landscape so well, and what's in it. Is there anything else that we should keep in mind from this statement that I haven't asked you about?
Well, you know, I think what the authors at the end they said. I liked the phrasing they used, which I thought was worth mentioning. They said that Pope Francis wants to break the organic link between culture, politics, institution, and church, which is, you know, a really interesting statement because those things are so interconnected, especially in our politics. But it's exactly because in our politics we have already seen such an interweaving of not even religion, it's really just theocracy and politics and belief, that I don't think you can break that link in this country at this point, or it's going to take a long process to break that link. So I think they're positing a vision for Pope Francis and for how he sees the future that is really just diametrically opposed to our politics in the United States, in which religion has become so interwoven into people's political identities.
Patty Miller is a longtime journalist with deep experience covering religion and its role in our culture. She's the author of the book Good Catholics, The Battle Over Abortion in the Catholic Church. We'll link to Patty's Religion Dispatches article headlined, Vatican Fires Shot at U.S. Religious Right Calls Out Religious Liberty Industry and Evangelical Catholic Alliance from stateofbelief.com. Patty, it's always great having you with us. Keep us posted on this, and thank you again for coming back and telling our State of Belief audience what's going on.
Thanks so much, Weldon.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. If you've made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week, I want to say a sincere thank you. If you've heard something on this week's show that you think would be helpful to someone you know, please share it with that person or persons. Direct them to stateofbelief.com, where they'll find full episodes and in-depth archive, extended interviews, transcripts, and links mentioned in the show. Be sure to follow us on Facebook and Twitter and engage in the discussion. Our producer is Ray Kirstein, who makes all of this possible. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
It's time we stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going on.